thank you for tuning in to episode 144 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. This is not going to be a gross episode, despite the fact that 144, which is a dozen dozens, is also called a gross. You can email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on prn.fm, or download the MP3 after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast aggregators. Listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. You'll be responsible for any long-distance charges. Remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. If you would like to sponsor this show, you can donate via PayPal to david.crow@theinfectiousmyth or use patreon.com/infectiousmyth for monthly donations. Even a dollar a month helps a lot. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information you are gleaning, for the support you get for some of your non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. And now to our interview. In May 2012, then 31-year-old Marissa Alexander was prosecuted for aggravated assault with a lethal weapon and received a mandatory minimum sentence of 20 years in prison. She said that she fired a warning shot after her husband attacked her and threatened to kill her on August 1st, 2010 in Jacksonville, Florida. She was released on January 27, 2015, under a plea deal that kept her sentence to the 3 years she had already served, and she's with me today. Welcome to the show, Marissa.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you with me today. I think a lot of people compared your case with the Trayvon Martin George Zimmerman case. But first of all, let me ask you a couple of questions. I don't want to get into too much details of the day you've asked me not to, but was your husband harmed in any way on that day?
No, he was not harmed.
Okay, so so it was essentially a warning shot. And also, were your children present on that at that time?
Right. So my stepchildren, from what I saw, were not anywhere in the location. As far as I knew, they had left the house. Mm-hmm. So by the time I, you know, left to get to the garage, which is not detached from my house, which is where my car is, which is where I would have gotten in my car to leave,
right,
and was not able to, they were not. When I left out to go to the garage, they were not in the house because everybody was supposed to be leaving as far as what I knew, but he was not leaving. So I did not, you know, when I discharged my firearm, they were nowhere to be seen or around him at all.
And your plan was to leave the property?
My plan was to leave. Right, right. So I parked in the garage that day. He did not. Normally he would have, but he did not. And then, you know, I asked him, I was like, why didn't you park in the garage? And he said, I don't know, something's wrong with it. It, you know, of course it didn't hit me because a couple of hours, maybe an hour or two later, when you're in the midst of fight or flight mode, that's not good. You know, you're not thinking about that. So, right. You know, when I was trying to leave after being attacked, because I was assaulted in the bathroom, you know, it wasn't one of those instances where, you know, that was completely overlooked, you know, that I was locked in the bathroom because I locked myself there. The door was broken in, assaulted then, and when I tried to leave is when, you know, I was unable to do so.
Right.
So my plan was to leave, but I was not able to.
Right. One thing that confuses me about the information I got from Wikipedia, which of course is not always accurate, is this this occurred in May 2012, is that correct?
No, this particular incident was August 1st of 2010. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. So in May 2012 is when you were prosecuted for what happened on August 1st, 2010.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I made a mistake in my introduction there. So there was a history of your husband abusing you before this event?
Yes. Right. There had been prior acts of violence towards me. I did not find out about the others toward anyone else until after I had, been, charged at that point and investigations were done by, private investigators is when I found that there were prior incidences with other women outside of one that I didn't know about. So within our relationship, there were other incidents.
And these were other girlfriends or?
Family members, girlfriends,
And what kind of range of violent incidents were, violent acts had he done before?
From what the reports say and depositions say, one of them, he had hit his brother in the face with a brick. He had to have stitches. Some type of altercation happened between those two when his brother tried to leave. He ran him off the road and then pulled him out of the car and beat him with a brick. That's what the report stated. The other female, he literally punched her in the mouth. When she called the police, he tried to rip the phone out the wall while as she was on the phone with the police. So that he would not get arrested, he stabbed himself with a fork. But luckily, that was caught on the line prior to him ripping the phone out the wall.
Wow, so it sounds like he has a little bit of a temper, to say the least.
Putting it mildly.
Yeah, I think I'm understating. Was he ever convicted or charged or convicted with any of these events?
He was for the female, I think, with his brother. I believe it was thrown out simply because it was a family issue and his brother was intoxicated. And so I think both of them were arrested, and I guess, at that point, I'm not quite sure what happened with that. I want to say it was thrown out. He was put on probation for the female that he punched in the mouth, which was one of the kids of his mother. He was put on probation for that in order to do anger management. And she had since, filed several different orders of protection along with other women that and family members who also had filed orders of protection throughout his life with him or against him.
So, I mean, not only a man who, in your opinion, was violent at times, but a man with a documented history of violence. And in Florida, they have this law called Stand Your Ground, and I guess there's quite a few states that have a Stand Your Ground law. And my understanding, and you can correct me because I'm sure you know a lot more about this than me, is that you don't have the requirement to retreat if you feel threatened by somebody. You can stand there, and if they continue to threaten you, you can use lethal force. That's my understanding. Is that
right.
About right?
Yeah, it's essentially an expansion of the self-defense law or CAFL doctrine, which is what I was trained under when I did my concealed weapons, class. When I had to defend myself that day, I had no awareness of your Stand Your Ground law, never heard of it. So, and it had been a while, at least it had been around at least 5 years prior to me even knowing anything about it.
Right.
So essentially, it gives you the ability to, meet force with force and not put you in a position where you have to retreat when you're in the most vulnerable position in a conflict in which you are feeling threatened or in fear of your life, where you have to retreat, which puts you in more harm, but you can stand and be force with force. And what they did was they expanded it so it could be outside of your home, any place where you have the right to be.
Okay, so it's not just on your own property. Stand Your Ground can, if you were, say, at a public park and somebody came up to you with a baseball bat, you, like, in self-defense, you would probably have to prove that you had no option to leave. But for Stand Your Ground, you don't have the responsibility to leave. You could use a gun or some other force on that person because they were threatening you. But that didn't work in your case, even though Stand Your Ground was brought into the case by your defense, I presume. So what did the judge or the, I guess you don't really know what the jury thought, but Did the judge say anything about why it was not accepted as a defense?
Well, essentially, the judge that I went to trial with was not the same judge that ruled against me in the stand your ground hearing in the motion that I, you know, that we filed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can speculate from my perspective what went down, which is basically this. During that time, it was pretty controversial because at that time, George Zimmerman, you know, his you know, case was in, you know, in the news.
Right.
And so during that time when it was established that they were going to do that, I remember having the hearing, and we stopped the hearing because he went on, you know, my ex-husband now went on the stand, and he was completely hostile. He was very upset, and so they stopped the hearing at that point to try to resolve the case, you know. So essentially, you know, the hearing at, you know, the judge made the hearing, I mean, she made the choice after trying to get Angela Corey to back up off of the minimum mandatory, which she would not. She made the choice, and her findings were basically that she didn't feel like I acted as a person who was in fear. And that was under the presumption that I came back into my home as if I left and went down the street, as if I went to a detached garage. I went to leave and wasn't able to, and then, you know, had no other way to leave but to go back in my house. When I came back into my house is where he engaged me. It wasn't a re-engagement of him, because if he was leaving, you know, at the front door where his car was, it would have been just that. He could have left that way.
Right.
The shot was not fired as they were leaving the house. The shot was fired when he engaged me and threatened. That's when I fired the shot.
Right. I mean, it seems, I'm not a lawyer, but it seems like this would be classic self-defense. I mean, if you're walking down the street and somebody starts to attack you, and you walk into your house, and that person follows you, mm-hmm. and you've mm-hmm. got a gun in your house, you think that self-defense would apply in that case. Like, somebody has invaded your property and is continuing to threaten
right.
you, you'd think just standard self-defense
right.
would apply. But none of that worked.
Right. And, you know, and then the thing about it is, you know, it would appear that it works for some and it doesn't for others. You know, you have an instance where, you know, I guess you would call it, victim per se, was still alive. So then it becomes a he said, she said type
right.
of scenario. When you have an instance where you know, a victim is killed, then it's your word against your word. And then you have
right.
the ability to not testify in your own defense. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so if, I mean, we can talk about George Zimmerman. By the time
mm-hmm.
he was charged,
right.
obviously Trayvon Martin was dead. And so George Zimmerman could say, Trayvon Martin was on top of me, therefore
mm-hmm.
threatening me. I used stand your ground, and that worked with him. There was no Trayvon Martin there to say, no, he was on top of me with a gun, which would have, if that had been accepted as the truth, probably would have resulted in a conviction, or hopefully. But
right.
like you say,
so,
only
yeah, I mean,
George Zimmerman's word was available.
Right. And not only that, was his word available, it was protected under the Fifth Amendment, where he does not have to testify. So then you get what you get is a pretty darn good lawyer, legal team that preserve that. You know, that's very, you know, important to defenses, that the witnesses do not, they hold on to that, you know, ability to not incriminate themselves. So
right.
essentially you're dealing with forensics and a hell of a good attorney team, and 3 weeks to plant any type of reasonable doubt. You have a special prosecutor comes in, overcharges, you know what I mean? And so at that point, the jury, you know, could not meet that burden of proof to say that, you know, it was premeditated first degree.
Yes. From a racial perspective, George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin was a little bit ambiguous, because George Zimmerman was Hispanic. It wasn't the standard white guy, black guy thing where the
mm-hmm.
racial aspect is clear. But it seems that there are a number of cases where black people have the legal right to have a weapon, and yet it results in their arrest or death. There was one guy, I should have looked up his name, but he was at a traffic stop, and he told the policeman mm-hmm. that he had a gun. He had the legal right to carry, and he ended up getting shot mm-hmm. by the policeman, probably because the policeman heard, "I have a gun," and was mm-hmm. fearful of myths of black men and felt mm-hmm. threatened just from his imagination.
Are you talking about Philando Castile?
Yes, that's the one. Thank you.
Okay.
So what do you think about that kind of case versus...
Well, here's the thing. On the surface in this level, looking at George Zimmerman, you're not going to be able to look at him and tell he's Hispanic. That's number one.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I understand, he's not fully Hispanic. He's white and Hispanic.
Right.
But just looking at him, if you had to look at him, you knew that he was non-black,
mm-hmm,
or he wasn't
mm-hmm.
black. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah,
no,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Let's just put that out there.
Right.
So,
okay.
You know, I don't have that. I mean, I don't, you look at me, it's automatically you can tell that. But then just, you know, I think you're talking about fear now, and then you're talking about going into a situation where you got stereotypes and biasness,
mm-hmm,
and, you know, those play a role. And, you know, law enforcement is human as well, but, I mean, at the same time, you didn't take the job, didn't think that at some point you would be fearful in a situation, but you had to know how to handle it under some type of training. You know what I'm saying?
Right, right. I mean, training is supposed to allow you to deal with situations that could be stressful while still thinking rationally.
Exactly. Well, and that's the issue that I had with my case, because, you know, at some point, you know, we're dissecting me as if I'm some B613 agent, you know, like I was supposed to, you know, you were supposed to do this, you know, you were supposed to do that, and you could have done this. And I was like, you know, I'm, you know, what was lost in the translation is the fact that I had just literally had a baby, for one.
Mm-hmm.
Two, this man is 100 pounds more than me, and
right.
he's threatening my life. You know, at this point, I feel like I did the best that I could do without harm. And this was not an incident where it was a disagreement and I didn't like what he said. And I'm like, you know what, hey, I'm going to just fire off a round. I mean, at this time I was 29, 30 years old and had had a weapon for quite some time. You have to imagine there was times where I had to be angry. Obviously, I had been in a previous, you know, situation where there was some, you know, obviously there was some prior acts of violence, and I could have used my weapon then and I did not. So that particular day, it wouldn't have been anything that set me off in terms of a comment that would have me act irrational. Does that
right.
make sense?
Yes, yes. I mean, I've noticed a few times where I've been in a slightly critical situation, like seeing a car accident or something, I found myself freezing because I don't know what to do, right? And
mm-hmm.
I think one of the things I admire about a lot of first responders is through their training in a stressful situation, they can often do what they're supposed to do, right? They're at a car accident. If I was at a car accident and say it was somebody I knew, I would be devastated, right? And I would probably be incapable of behaving normally. But it seems like there are some policemen that cannot get past that if they have a feeling that all black men are dangerous or something like that. All black
right.
people,
and,
I guess,
you know,
in your case, you're not a man, obviously.
And, you know, I think it goes with your experience, and I think it goes with just, you know, volatile situations. I think, you know, you go into a situation with your stereotypes and your, you know, your biases and your, you know, your experiences with whatever it is, right? So, say for instance, to put it, you know, because I've had a lot of law enforcement that actually agreed with what I did, you know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, they did. And the idea is this, is that, you know, they go into their job and, you know, there's a special training, and then, you know, some of this stuff is just trigger happy, you know what I mean? Some of this
mm-hmm.
stuff can be de-escalated, I believe. I don't believe all things should turn out fatally. I don't believe that all
right.
things, especially with no weapons, should be. I don't understand that, to be quite frank with you.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's me, who take on the other hand that, you know, I feel some type of way about being in the company of law enforcement now. I think most people, black people, are probably feeling that way. So if you're being pulled over, there's a hypersensitivity because of the climate. Does that make sense?
Right.
So perhaps in their perspective, perhaps they feel the same way. Then again goes the question of understanding all of those variables. There's a special type of training, And there's a special type of standard that you're held to that's just a little bit higher. I get that you're human. Nobody's going to take that from you.
Right.
But you didn't go into a job where you were being a veterinarian. You went into a job where there's, you know, to protect and serve. And so those instances where you're going to run into some hostile or volatile situations. And what I can't understand is the escalation of certain situations, especially when there's no firearm and there's no weapons. That's where I'm confused as to why lethal force is being the first option as opposed to the very last.
Yeah. It seems like there was that child in, I think, Cincinnati in the park, 10 years old, who had a
right.
toy gun. There's far too many of those situations, and I think the statistics in the United States bear out that there are many more killings by police, and particularly of black men. I think some people have mm-hmm. noted that there are more killings of white people than black people by the police, but then blacks are only 14% of the population, and it's definitely
right.
more than 14% of the victims of a police shooting. It's not to say that every killing is unjustified. There are obviously times where there's no choice, unfortunately.
Right.
Why was it that you had a gun? Was it because you feared your husband, or were there other reasons for you getting a concealed carry permit?
Well, you know, to kind of give you, just to give you some contextual background. I mean, my father is retired military.
Mm-hmm.
He has three girls. You know, I have always been comfortable around weapons, and I've been around them since I was at least 12 years old. Okay, he put all of us in some type of, self-defense, so jiu-jitsu or taekwondo when we were younger.
Mm-hmm.
He'd take us to the range. He did that for years. So there was a certain responsibility that, you know, we had and respected weapons as a, you know, as a privilege as well as a right to carry one. My dad always carried one.
Right.
And he always had a concealed weapons license. So when I decided to get one, being that I was a female, I was working later hours, and I was actually getting my master's at the time. So I was, you know, leaving work, getting out of school at 10. So it would be sometimes even later than that. So I decided, let me go ahead and, you know, get something just in case I needed to. And I always kept it in my vehicle. I never brought it into the house because I didn't have a gun safe, which is what my father had. So this
right.
wasn't an instance where I went and got it because I was in this relationship. I would have been around, you know, firearms, for as long as I can remember, and so it's a part of my upbringing.
Right. Now you were trained, and is this necessary for a concealed carry permit in Florida?
I want to say that you can, that you don't have to, you just can't open carry unless you have a permit. And that might have changed because, you know, I'm kind of out of the loop on that because I can't have one anymore. But,
okay.
As far as open carry, but, you know, I believe you have to have a permit. So, you know, I did go and get the permit, the fingerprint and send it off, and I had a concealed weapons permit license.
Right. It was interesting because you did some training on shooting, how to use the gun safely, things like that. But it doesn't sound like
mm-hmm.
you had any training on stressful situations, which is presumably part of police training, that, you know, when
mm-hmm.
you're using a gun, when perhaps somebody has a gun or is maybe using the gun on you, like, that's a completely different thing than learning how to use the gun safely at the range, for example.
Right. You know, I mean, how to operate it, you know, when and where to carry it. There's certain places, even with concealed weapons license, if you're not law enforcement, you can't carry. That type of training
mm-hmm.
is the kind of stuff that we went into, where to shoot, you know, where to shoot at, you know, and we actually did some shooting. Honestly, the classes are a day long. It is not meant to treat, you know, for you to be taught how to, you know, be a SWAT member. I mean, seriously.
Well,
that's something you want to do
right.
going on later. I don't know
right.
how to go about that, but
there may be some civilian training like that. Just like you can, you know, take your car onto a racetrack as a civilian and do things you couldn't normally do, but I don't imagine too many people do that. One thing that strikes me is often is said by people who are in favor of everybody having a gun, or lots of people having guns, as Second Amendment activists, I guess, is that, you know, the only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. But from what I can see, under stressful situations. For example, let's say that you're in a movie theater and somebody starts shooting, that even somebody mm-hmm. with a gun realizes that now it's very difficult to use that gun because you're maybe not entirely sure who the shooter is, the lights are out, that this imagination you had of being the hero where you could stand up and shoot the shooter, that's mm-hmm. not reality, even with some training.
Right. And I mean, I think a lot of that is a bit, you know, far-fetched. I can't think of right off the top of my head, where there was an instance where somebody was, you know what I mean, lethal weapon two in an incident who wasn't a cop. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
the kind of stuff that happens, it ensues out of some type of, you know, argument between two people. Maybe they know each other. Maybe
right.
they don't. Most of the time, they do know each other.
Yes.
And it's instance where, you know, it's on somebody's property. It's very, you know, it's getting to the point where it's getting a little, you know, obviously vigilantism. It's people just like, I got the right to do it. But that's not, you know, something that I, you know, have seen. Particularly if an instance for me went down like that, I'm trying to get the hell out and call the police. That's not something I'm trying to handle because I'm not trained to do that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But but if somebody is threatening my life in my space in a place where I'm supposed to be able to be and I have the right to protect myself, of sure that I should be able to do that. But to be some type of, you know, that's not something that I would choose to do. I would let the authorities who can do that, do that. Now, there's people out there who feel like they can, and they've retired military or whatever. By all means, if you want to give it a shot, go ahead. That's not something that I would do.
Right, right. I understand. I mean, I think that was what was so shocking about your case is it seemed like you were doing everything right and that using
right.
your gun was the last resort. And even then, you didn't assert your right. Like, understand your ground. You probably had the right to shoot and kill your husband. If that
yeah,
had been accepted, but you chose not to do that, to
mm-hmm.
minimize the damage to a hole in the wall,
mm-hmm.
and I presume
mm-hmm.
your husband left at that point.
Right, he did. It worked. And
yes.
that was the whole argument. You know, like I say, you know, it's me defending myself, and he did not have a weapon, but his hands was a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
I just had a baby. He had assaulted me already. And so
right.
I was supposed to wait for him to kill me and then come back alive. I mean, the whole argument to me sometimes is just really dumb. You
yeah.
know what I mean? That's the way I've always felt. I've just never been able to kind of interview about it. But just the mere fact that, you know, even in the state's arguments when they did file a brief, you know, one of the arguments was I should have went out the back window or I should have went through the window or why can't I just go
really?
To the front door? And it was like,
a glass window.
Isn't that the whole
window.
Purpose of stand your ground? Like,
have you ever jumped through a glass window?
I mean, no, but I think if I was like a, what do you call those people, a stunt woman, that would be kind of cool.
Well,
but I mean,
the problem is if you, yeah, if you try to jump through a window and you only get halfway through and then you land on jagged pieces of glass, you could kill yourself, right?
Right. And honestly, when you're in a fight or flight, it's just that. You're either going to run, which is what I tried to do, and when I couldn't, I fought. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so I had at my disposal my firearm, which I keep in my truck. That's always been in my truck. And at that point, I was like, okay, I can't get out through the garage, and the only way to go is back through the garage. And he was engaging me. He was coming towards me even then again. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
The whole premise is for you to be able to do exactly what I did.
Right.
And lethal force doesn't. I mean, protecting yourself in self-defense doesn't always have to end up in a fatality. You know, I
right.
had his child. I married him. I did love him at some point. It worked. He backed off, and it worked.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, I feel like I was penalized and punished because I did that. And of course, then you know his lies that he continued to do about the kids were around, which absolutely I would have never. And, you know, one of his sons actually testified in my defense at trial. I was like, no, that wasn't the case. I didn't see it. I wasn't there, you know.
Right.
So, yeah.
So your stepchildren you're referring to are his children from a previous relationship?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
Have your thoughts on guns for self-defense changed throughout this traumatic situation?
You know, no, I don't believe so. And I still feel like people should have the right to stand your ground. I don't feel like, you know, the law should change in the sense that I know some people that were against it. I think what needs to happen is that people need to be educated about it. Attorneys need to be educated about it. Law enforcement needs to be, and so do judges, because ultimately they are the ones who make the decisions at first. And even when you are granted, say, for instance, that you are arrested for whatever reason, like I was, George Zimmerman was not until after the fact. Mm-hmm. So the law enforcement at the scene was like, oh, okay, great. Yeah, it was stand your ground, not until you hear the tapes later when he's being told, hey, you don't have to do that. And, you know, again, I don't understand how you antagonize the argument and then decide, wait, I'm in fear, and then do that. You know, that wasn't the case with me. You know what I mean? So that you have to be, you know, careful with that. When you say, weren't you supposed to be there? What was the issue? Why were you, well, when I went to approach them, they did this, and why did you go do that? These are things that need to be kind of sorted out. And so I believe the law still has some definite room for improvement, but I believe that you should have the right to not, in a space where, like, for instance, when I'm vulnerable and I'm already been attacked, to continue to run out of my own home. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, you know, I outside of the context of stand your ground, I don't understand how the decision to prosecute you and convict you, how that was justified, since it seems like a pretty clear case of self-defense. And, you know, with your husband's ex-husband, I presume, ex-husband's history of violence, you would think that would mean that his proclamations that he meant no harm, I presume he said that, I'm just guessing, were maybe not true, since he had a history of...
Yeah, and that's the thing, you know. I mean, it wasn't one of these things where, you know, I didn't know, or I hadn't been on the receiving end, you know, of that, and that I quite possibly believed that day that, you know, it could have been a fatal situation, because he was at that complete, you know, space of anger. So, you know, but to me, it's absurd to anybody's argument to say, well, you know, you left out the house and you came back. And, if I have pictures, like I'm looking at this stuff now, and a lot of this stuff wasn't, you know, in my first trial, did not come into play to really give you context of what was going on and say, you know, it was in fact justified for me to do what it is I did. I believe, like I said, the political climate at that time, in terms of what was going on with George Zimmerman's case, my then judge, her husband was the under sheriff. She was new to the bench. You know, I think that, you know, she really had a hard time, which I think a lot of these judges in this particular circuit were really conservative, probably didn't want to rule in it, when in fact they seen cases that did justify, you know, the use of stand your ground. They would not rule for whatever reason. And so, you know, I think those are things that, you know, really tamper with people's rights when you decide, you know, I don't want to ruffle the feathers, and I can't, you know, I don't want to do that for whatever reason, so I'm going to rule against. And I think that's the kind of stuff that sets the tone for people to do what they do, is change the law and make different changes. Because there was a law that was passed, it was called the warning shot law. I don't know much about it, because by that time, you know, my case was in full throttle and it just wasn't something I looked into, but I don't believe it would have helped me, because it would have passed it at that point. It wasn't retroactive.
Right, you would think, like, as an outsider, not knowing much about the legal system, you would think that if you fired a warning shot, you didn't hurt anybody, that you might mm-hmm. be charged with, careless use of a firearm or something, which I presume doesn't have a 20-year sentence, although maybe I don't know that. I mean, obviously there are cases where, you know, if you pull out a gun in a party of people and just fire it into the roof, that's mm-hmm. that's a completely different situation, completely unprovoked, unjustified. You've endangered people's right. lives. You don't know, there might be somebody upstairs,
right.
that kind of stuff.
Right.
But this
right.
this seemed like
right.
a very
exactly.
special case.
It just wasn't that the case with me. Yeah, it wasn't. Mm. And I think as my case went on, it was, especially once it made it, you know, because I just knew it was wrong from the beginning, you know. But then the sit through trial, and what most people don't know is the attorneys in the trial were like, okay, so what are we going to do to process her out? Like, the judge was shocked. I mean, he was shocked at the verdict. You know, it was just one of those things where everybody was like, really? You know, but the jury instructions, and you, again, when you compare my case to George Zimmerman, you're talking about my trial was 2 days.
Right.
2 days. Okay. With 3 or 4 or 5 different witnesses. And not only that, the previous women were not, the judge decided that he did not want, you know, to allow their actual testimonies into, you know, trial. And then, you know, you talk about George Zimmerman, who didn't have to testify in his own defense. Okay.
Right.
And he had 3 weeks, and it was, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's
right.
Different. You know,
what
so
were
it's
the,
not comparing apples to oranges.
Right. What were the witnesses who were excluded?
The women that had prior acts of violence committed against them from him.
And why were they excluded? What was the justification?
I believe one testified, and I think he was the term, and don't quote me, was called cumulative. So at that point, the other lady didn't need to testify. You already had one, and so the rest of them didn't need to.
But,
I guess that's what the premise was at.
Right, but that could lead the jury to say, okay, he lost his temper once. You know,
right,
everybody makes mistakes,
that,
right?
You know, exactly. But to actually show that this person has a propensity to be violent, and by excluding those women and their stories, you know, obviously didn't help in my case. I think when we were getting ready to go back to the, you know, trial the second time, we filed a motion that their testimonies would be allowed.
Right. And so in early, pardon me, go ahead.
No, I'm done.
Okay. So in early 2015, there was a plea deal. So under that deal, did they change what you were convicted of, change the crime, or how did they take a mandatory sentence of 20 years down to 3 years time served?
Well, I mean, that was at that point was the plea, so that was the minimum mandatory for that crime if you did not seek the enhancement. So here's the thing about the 10-20 life. The prosecution has, you know, we have legislation, but the prosecution has discretion on whether or not they're going to enhance a particular crime with the enhancement. So at any point, he could have, she could have, meaning, and the district attorney could have waived the minimum mandatory, but she did not. So essentially, once she waived the minimum mandatory, the enhancement of the 10-20 life, it took it down to 3 years. You know, you had to do 3 years as a minimum for that 10-20 life. So that's where that comes in.
Okay, I understand. And what was the crime you were convicted of?
Aggravated assault with a deadly weapon.
Aggravated
with no intent to harm.
With no intent to harm.
Right.
Okay, now, a lot of people have commented on this, that in the United States, these mm-hmm. decisions are in the hands of the prosecutor. You know, if you ask a prosecutor, here you got a bad guy, do you want to throw the book at him? It seems like the prosecutor's going to say, yeah, I'm up for election next year or something, so the more stiff sentences I give, the better. You'd think the judge would be much better placed to say, you know, this crime was aggravated because it was against a racial minority, because it was against a domestic partner, something like that. There, you know, the judge would seem like in a much better place to decide on that and much less biased.
Well, and that's my whole argument. Well, you know, why would you put the ability for the person it benefits the most to have full discretion? Of course I'm going to use it. You know what I mean? Like, it's going to force you into a plea? Great. If it's going to, you know, if you go to trial, you're going to get the max, great. You know, either way, I'm going to get me a conviction for the both parts.
Right. It's kind of like putting children into charge of the size of the ice cream cone that they get at the store, right? Like, they're always going to get the triple scoop, even if it's not good for them.
Right. Exactly. And so, you know, just looking at the intent of it all should have been enough reason, because from what I understand, and, you know, you had a particular, legislation body say, you know, this was not intended. This is not what this was intended for, this 10-20 life. You know, prior to me, there was a gentleman who I used his case law to actually get my case reversed. He was a veteran, and he discharged the weapon. He didn't hurt anybody, and it was to protect a neighbor against, you know, that neighbor's teenager or son or whatever the case may be.
Right.
And, you know, they prosecuted him, and he ended up getting 20 years and got it reversed or whatnot. But, you know, yeah, that wasn't the intent. Never had been in trouble. You know, veteran had never been in trouble, concealed weapon from it, and he had the same thing happen. That wasn't the intent. The intent was for habitual violent offender, you know, but...
Yeah, yeah. It seems like prosecutors are supposed to search for justice, and they have this tool which, like you say, they should use if somebody's been in front of the courts many times for violent behavior. This is a way to, you know, to get that person behind bars for a long time. But for somebody in both in your case and in the other case you describe, where there's some justification for the use of a gun, that just seems wrong to throw the enhancements at the accused.
So then you have to ask the question, you know, how many of us that it has happened to? And what I got to see when I was incarcerated was a bias towards, you know, the, you know, seems like, you know, people of, you know, color seem to have gotten an enhancement off right.
Mm-hmm.
But people who were not of color had at least a consideration that the enhancement would not be applied. And that gives you a little bit more flexibility to not have to worry about, okay, if I, you know, don't, if they offer me a plea, that's even if they offer you a plea, because if they don't, then, you know, you have no choice but to accept that or go to trial. But if they offer me, you know, a plea and I don't take it, then I have this minimum mandatory that's only, you know, if they do and they waive it. So, yeah, I've talked about that
with guests before, this deal where a prosecutor can say, if you go to trial, we're going to go for 10, 20 years, we're going to go for life, but here's mm-hmm. a 3-year plea deal. And mm-hmm. even if you're innocent, you may take that deal. And part of the deal mm-hmm. is you plead guilty and accept
right.
3 years in prison, because if you want to roll the dice, you go to court. And on the one hand, if you're lucky, you get acquitted. And on the other hand, you get what they told you they were going to give you, 20 years,
right.
life, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. One thing a lot of people have difficulty with, to somewhat change the subject, you obviously have documented that your husband was abusive in the past.
Mm-hmm.
You've said you loved him in the past. Can you comment on, you know, staying with an abusive man, like how does it happen that you end up in this situation and not getting out of it? Like, what are the sort of the forces that keep you in a relationship after it turns abusive?
Well, you know, a lot of the times, you know, it's a these relationships are, you know, complex in terms of, you know, how it works and in how they come together and what's going on in them. I believe a lot of people stay in unhealthy relationships, whether they're being abused or not. I mean, that's not uncommon.
Mm-hmm.
But then you add in the extra the piece of, okay, when somebody's being physically, emotionally, or, you know, verbally abusive to you, then why is it that you stay? I believe in my instance, and I'll speak to me, which also speaks to a lot of other women, you know, this guy doesn't come with a sign that says, hey, in about 2 days, 2 weeks, 2 months, I'm going to be strangling you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they are charming. You are in the best time of your life. And then all of a sudden, for me, you know, something happens. And I'm like, oh, my God, like, where's the guy that I fell for? What happened? You know what I mean? Like, he must have a temper problem. So then they come back because it happens. And, you know, he's explaining, okay, listen, I'm sorry. You know, this is what happened with me. You know, I did this. I shouldn't have did it. This is happening in my life. And you know, are forgiving of that for, you know, many reasons. You know what I mean? And so, you know, our relationship was not 5 years long. It was very short, actually. And I know the news made it seem like it was a long affair, and it was not. It was pretty short, pretty tumultuous. And it was an exercise and a control that I could not get with, which is why we had so much tension, because, you know, I have my own mind.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, whenever he, you know, would express these things to me, I was forgiving, and I would talk to him like anybody else in a relationship, whether they're being violated, mistreated, cheated on. It was just an added extra, you know. And this is the thing. He wasn't, like, whipping me up every day I came home. That was not the case. It was just these instances where they were violent, and they were, you know, pretty sporadic, and they were, like, four or five in the time that we were together, which was pretty much in turns about a year.
Right.
You know, I couldn't imagine doing years and years on hand of it. But there's a lot of complexity that I didn't have an instance where I depended on him financially.
Right.
You know, I wanted to believe that he would be better. I wanted to believe that the guy that I fell in love with was actually that guy, and it just maybe needed some work with somebody who was, who didn't have a temper, who could work with him. But the fact of the matter is, he is who he is. He does what he does. That's his background. That's where he comes from, and I didn't know that. And so a lot of times, you know, people say.
Yeah, and I think if you had your child, that was your only child with him, right? And you were pregnant. You had just given birth, so you didn't have previous children, and you didn't have financial ties, whereas a lot of women are financially dependent on their husbands, and they may have a couple of kids already, which makes it seemingly that much more difficult. Well, in reality, that was more difficult to get out. You have to go to a women's shelter. You don't know how that's going to work. How are you going to...
And a lot of times they hold them. They harass them. I've seen it in court where, you know, they hold their house hostage. The woman does leave. And then some way or another, you know, he gets her into court by way of a restraining order, pretty much puts her in a position where she has nowhere to go but to go back. I've seen these type of things. Sometimes these women come from that background, and it's unhealthy, and that's what their representation of love is, so that's normal to them, you know what I mean?
Right.
Because they've seen it, you know, that just wasn't the case with me. You know, I was pretty patient with a guy that I fell in love with who I thought just had a bad temper. It didn't really dawn on me that I was in a domestic violence relationship.
Right.
It never occurred to me. And so when, in fact, I became clear about this, these batterers, and there's a profile, and there's a behavior, and it's a control, it was very clear to me, and I was like, oh, okay. Now I understand where I am, and that this is never going to change. He's not going to change. This is never going to stop. And so that's when my exit plan was executed, but August 1st happened, so.
So you had already left him on August 1st when these events happened. You were separated.
Yeah, we were, yeah.
I mean, was that the
staying with my mom.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was staying with my mom. I would go home to that house on the weekend because it was my home that I had leased out. But I would go to the house, but I was taking things from it, you know, little by little, so he wouldn't know that I was kind of exiting that relationship. I mean, you just don't up and leave because it's the most vulnerable time for a woman to leave in an abusive relationship. You don't just say, hey, I'm out. You know, it does not work like that. You deal with, you know, issues of control. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, sadly, there are a lot of men, not all men, obviously, just a tiny minority, but there are definitely some men who cannot accept that a woman would leave, and even though that there's no love left in the relationship, they still want that control.
And they deal with rejection. You know, they feel rejected. Mm-hmm. They feel, you know what I mean? It's a host of different things that, you know, come from, you know, whatever their past is and whatever they've dealt with, you know, whatever traumatic experience or whatever they was exposed to that never gets dealt with. And so it kind of passes itself on. And it's not just men against women. Women, you know, are abusive toward men too.
Mm-hmm,
and that's why we phrase it as intimate partner violence, because that is the case with some women that do that to men as well. And a lot of that, and it's just domestic and meaning in the home. It could be, you know, parents against children. It could be elderly. You know, it's just the propensity to be violent towards someone in the result of to control somebody else.
Right, and I think with men, when they're the victims of violence, they feel ashamed that the guy mm-hmm. who's bigger and stronger is being abused, mm-hmm. right? It seems.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, let's talk about the future. You have a new nonprofit now. Can you describe what the purpose of that is?
Yeah, it's mostly DVSA, which is domestic violence, sexual assault, and social justice issues is what I'm focused on. And the reason, the best way I could describe it is that, you know, for so many people that supported me and for me having, you know, the ability to experience what I did from seeing it from, you know, a bird's eye view now, but also being in the trenches of it, going through the system and actually seeing that a lot of the things that are at a result of so many at the you know core of so many people's issues with crime stem from some type of abuse of some sort or some type of violence in their past,
mm-hmm.
and so with those things not being resolved or you know that stagnate that type of trauma you know permeates its way itself in different type of ways. Either that person is angry or goes out and does crime, that's what they do, that's what, you know, that's their norm, their social norm, and so it kind of, you know, translates on out. And
it's kind of inherited.
Exactly. And so I noticed that not only just with women, but I noticed that with men. And then just understanding the social justice issue that pretty much adds another layer on top of it, because for me, you know, I experienced, you know, obviously, you know, the 1020 life, which is a policy reform legislation. You're talking about mass incarceration. When you're given lengthy sentences, when you are charging juvenile adults and giving them life sentences and direct filing them at the age of 12, you
yes.
know, this is mass incarceration. This is a big issue. School-to-prison pipeline is huge. It's real. I know here in Duval, we direct file more youth or juveniles than any other county in the state of Florida. So, you know, these are things that I wanted to take up that I seen, and just being able to be in the mix of it and see how the system works and how it's not working. And just, I have radical different thoughts on how to certain issues. I don't have all the answers, but from what I've seen, I just have a different viewpoint on how to kind of, you know, correct some of the stuff, you know. So I said, hey, not only that's the best way to give back. People supported me. They rallied for me. They protested for me. They spoke out against my case. And the best way for me to give back is to lend my name, my services, my work, my experience to the community.
And what's the name of your nonprofit?
Marissa Alexander Justice Project. And it's on the web. It's MarissaAlexander.org. And, you know, I'm just not looking for donations. I'm looking for people to invest in the work that, you know, we would like to do, because, you know, we're at a point now where everything is so technology driven that, you know, people just assume, why can't the kids just get it together? And, you know, the social norm is the behaviors and their environments and from which they come from. And people just assume that how maybe you were raised, that people are being raised like that now, and they're not. You know, we're dealing with the fallout of the crack epidemic and mm-hmm. those kids that mentally are not right. And you know
right.
what I'm saying? And so as if they're not right, they're going to school, they're getting in trouble, then they get into the system. I mean, these are things, and these are talking about generations and generations of people who are doing the same thing, that have no exposure to what a healthy relationship looks like, access to education, living in poverty. All these things play a part in it. And so I just wanted to kind of, you know, be a part of,
well,
you know,
I think
issues.
Too much of the justice system is deciding that what hasn't, the things you've done haven't worked in the past, so what you need is more
exactly.
of the things that haven't worked.
exactly.
You're also writing a book, so what's your book going to cover?
You know what? The book kind of gives you an idea of who I am. I think that most people didn't get to see that. I'm still surprised that when I go and travel and I speak at a college or university, how many people did not realize that I had a master's degree.
I think there's stereotypes that every black person is uneducated and without a job. It's still that stereotype exists.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. If you're not exposed, to see, if you, and it's people, and this is just the reality, okay? If you're not exposed to, you know, in an environment where it's, you know, culturally rich, and you get to interact with different people, and your only frame of reference is from what you see on TV or the stuff that you hear on media, then you're going to probably have that idea. You know what I mean? Like, you might do that. And it's unfortunate, but it's true. And so my whole thing is just to come, just deal with it. Like, if you're fearful, you have a right to be, because this is what they show you on TV. You know what I mean? Like,
you mean
I get
TV
that.
Is so not an accurate reflection of reality?
Well, it depends. You know what I mean? Here's the thing. If you're showing this particular image all the time, then you're probably going to say, hey, this is what it's like. If you don't get exposed to different things and cultures and understand different things, then you're probably going to have this idea. Like, if I looked at TV or different things, I would never think that, you know, white people fight.
Yeah.
I don't think you fight. You know what I mean? Like, I think you guys, you know, are pretty agreeable, and everybody's living in harmonious. I mean, seriously, like, in harmonious, you
right?
know, great.
Yeah.
But it's not. You know what I mean? That's not the case. Everybody's dealing with just about the same issues. You know, we don't get into now, like, look at TV. All of a sudden now, drugs is a sickness now. It wasn't when crack was out.
Yeah,
you know
yeah.
What I mean?
It's,
now,
and now...
drug on pills, it's...
Right.
I mean, you know what I mean? That kind of...
Right. Now
so,
we have to be empathetic because white people are caught up in the opioid epidemic, but that didn't seem
exactly.
to occur during the war on drugs. Anyway, that's a whole other issue. We don't have time for that because we're running out of time. So I will put in a link to your nonprofit's website, and hopefully I'll find out when your book is published. And
do something pretty big.
Yes. And I would just like to thank you for joining me today.
Yeah, well, thank you for your interest and, you know, asking the questions and, you know, giving me an opportunity to kind of lay out things that I hadn't been able to do before and maybe that I help people to some degree. And the book is actually going to really give you a look at it from my eyes in terms of I want pictures and things and that people didn't get to see, get to know who I am and just really kind of experience it, walk it with me. That's the intent.
Okay, well, I've really enjoyed talking to you, and thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to episode 144 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.